Welcome to the DMD edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the Duchenne muscular dystrophy community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. Today we're at the Cure Duchenne Futures Conference in Orlando, Florida, talking with Dr. Michael Kelly, Chief Scientific Officer at Cure Duchenne. He's been with the organization for 11 years after a 30-year career with Pfizer, GlaxoSmithKline, and Amgen. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about Cure Duchenne and its mission, its objectives, and what is your role in the organization?
So let's start backwards. So my role is Chief Scientific Officer, and the focus there really is to accelerate cures to treat boys with this disease. It really means forging deep relationships with biotech and pharma companies. We're forward-facing into that. And in there, we bring our expertise, both deepened knowledge with drug discovery, drug development, as well as the KOL network, and the CRO network, in order to help these organizations accelerate what they're doing.
How would you characterize the current state of research on Duchenne muscular dystrophy?
Well, where we are today is the culmination of a decade's worth of priming the pump, so to speak. And we've certainly seen our sense of failures because drug development is inherently risky. But I think today, you know, we can look forward to some therapies that are looking as if they're going to be quite transformative. A great example of that is exon skipping. The first drugs that were approved a handful of years ago had severe limitations in use and efficacy. And that there brought around new technologies that really has driven innovation in that. And today we're seeing Sarepta with their PPMO, their cell-penetrating oligonucleotides, exon-skipping drugs, that are in late-stage clinical development. And then closely tied in behind that, there's a handful of other companies like Dyne, Avidity, and others that really are accelerating new technologies in order to focus and make exon-skipping not only more directed towards muscle, but much more efficient in general.
The problem, though, is that exon skipping tends not to treat all patients or even most patients, but rather a segment of the patient population.
Yeah, that's true. Right. There are things that I would certainly consider are mutation-specific drugs. They are going to serve a subset of the population. But there's significant advantages to exon skipping. One is that the dystrophin transcript that they produce is much, much larger, probably about 90% of normal size. And that has real influences on the functional output of that. These are the type of transcripts that we typically see in Becker muscular dystrophy people, individuals who may be asymptomatic for the disease. So we know that the protein that's been produced here is a highly functional and relevant one.
In terms of the approach to research in general, Cure Duchenne works as an equity investor in companies as well as invest partially in others. Can you talk about the Cure Duchenne model of funding research as opposed to how maybe some other nonprofits might do it?
Yeah, we have a real major focus on drug development. And those investments that we make, if successful, and we have been extremely successful at it, have fed money back into the system. So it's almost a self-propelling organization. Here that, you know, we've made investments both at middle and late stage as companies have gone through the IPO. And that's allowed us to actually reap the rewards of success. You have to remember that science and business is hard linked and hardwired together. You know, success in science, it will lead to investors actually making money. And at the end of the day, patients will benefit from all of that there. If we make mistakes and there's no return on investment, there's no upside for patients out of that. And so the whole business of science and the way that their finance side comes together is critically important in driving innovation and speeding it up. And we tend to focus on companies where the amount of money that we can put in along with their expertise can either help de-risk a platform or accelerate it.
You mentioned a few success stories. Can you describe some of them?
No, there's a number out there. I think that we've certainly helped companies that are in public domain right now. Avidity, Dyne, PepGen, involved in exon skipping. We were early funders in Bamboo, that is now the gene therapy program that Pfizer's in phase 3 trials with. Founders of the company Exonics that Vertex eventually acquired, and that there's their CRISPR-Cas technology that's been forging a path forward into Duchenne. So quite a broad range. Also, some companies are involved in bone because we want to be able to treat the whole disease. So we're really focused on all of those things that actually we think are going to be critically important in trying to improve the phenotype and accelerate research for this generation of boys.
And yet there's been some some failures as well, as was mentioned in the panel in the opening presentation this morning. Trials that didn't work, trials that disappointed, as they're bound to be in any disease, correct?
That is a normal nature of drug development. I've often described to people that drug development is, it's incredibly difficult in order to do successfully. It takes a combination of both good science, good management teams, as well as real experience in there and money, obviously. And I think the vast majority of projects will fail to cross over the final line. There's the nature of drug development. But each one of those projects that don't make it teaches a tremendous amount about what's wrong, whether it's something that's inherently wrong in our understanding of the disease or in the molecule itself. And we can focus technology on that. And this, a good example of where that there's worked is the early exon skipping drugs that's now given rise to these muscle-directed cell-penetrating peptides that are extremely efficient. And so failures are an important part, and attrition is an important part of us, because that's how we actually learn to modify and improve.
How important or central is gene therapy to the overall picture of research in Duchenne?
I think it's going to be critical. As much as we've talked a bit about the exon-skipping drugs, and basically because, you know, we're producing a much larger transcript, gene therapy is mutation agnostic right now. And so it potentially could treat a much larger swathe of patients that are out there.
Up to 80%, I understand.
It's possible, but I don't have the whole numbers yet. You know, one of the things that's going to prohibit uptake of it is certainly patients that are being pre-exposed to neutralizing antibodies. And so they're not going to be able to get this therapy. And that might be as high as 30 to 40 to 50%. We literally don't know. We don't test a population for that. And that'll certainly something that's come out after these drugs are approved. We'll understand that with more granularity. But I do feel that the early results that's come out from Pfizer, Sarepta, and others really has demonstrated a benefit in younger patient population. There we've seen significant amounts of the transgene put in muscle, correctly assembled with its binding partners. And the upside there is we've seen improvement and strength and time function tests. The North Star improvements are unprecedented against what would normally be a decline in natural history. So there's absolutely no doubt that the introduction of gene therapy, whenever it's approved, I think perhaps maybe as early as next year, is going to be transformative for a significant subset of patients.
As early as next year?
It's possible. I consider that based on we've got two companies in late stage phase three trials right now, in registration trials. You know, and it really is up to how fast they can recruit and engage regulators to approve the data. But it's imminent, essentially.
I'd like you to address, if you would, this this controversy on steroids. Mm-hmm. Some work better than others. Some have very serious side effects. Maybe others don't. And yet, as we have heard, if something is working, don't fix it.
So let's focus on the bit that's not controversial to begin with, and then we can start to dig in. The thing that's not controversial is that steroids have quite a beneficial effect in this disease. It prolongs, their use prolongs ambulation. It prevents scoliosis. And there's a number of other factors in there that it clearly has a significant benefit for boys. And for those reasons, it has been adopted as the standard of care now for quite a while. The controversy really surrounds which steroid or which dose, or which dosing frequency, because the effects of these in patients seem to almost be patient-specific. Some patients will tolerate it extremely well, other ones won't. The side effects really will be prevalent in those, and they'll skirt around looking for either an alternative steroid, they'll move between prednisone and deflazacort, or they'll move between an optimal dose to reduce the dose. They'll go from daily dosing to weekend dosing, and so it's a highly personalized decision. One of the things that I've often talked to parents about is it is the most difficult and most early decision that they have to make in Duchenne, is when to start steroid and what steroid to start and how to dose them. And we don't have, while we have a real consistency about they are important and they will preserve muscle and function and actually improve it, at the end of the day, there is real controversy about what is the best way, because it is independent on the, it is dependent upon the individual.
Of course. I wanted to ask before we wrap up on quality of life and life expectancy. Now, we have seen the life expectancy of Duchenne boys rise significantly in the last 20, 30 years. And yet, just as important as how long somebody lives is the quality of his life. How much has life expectancy improved, and how much has the quality of life of those boys improved as well?
Tremendously. And I think this has really come out of work that we've done over the last many years, really, to not only understand steroids better, but standard of care. Part of our operation at Curacy and Cares is to get out and train PT physiotherapists, really specializing in this disease and understanding how you treat boys and muscle and contractures. Diets are much more improved. The way that we can exercise some of these boys without damaging muscle. So all of this, this is really embedded within the natural history. We've watched the natural history change and evolve over the last 20 years. It's pretty stable right now. And I think that that there is really a benefit to both boys and families, particularly as I think real meaningful therapeutics are being approved right now.
Dr. Kelly, thank you very much for your time. This is Larry Luxner, Rare Disease Advisor. Thank you.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.